Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Alan Levy Show at blogtalkradio.com. Be prepared to call in now and chat with Alan and his very special guest right here at blogtalkradio.com. With no more further ado, please welcome your host, Mr. Alan Levy.
Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to the Alan Levy Show on Blog Talk Radio. I'm a host on Blog Talk Radio and actually the founder of this radio platform. And thank you for joining us today. Today is December 1st, 2008, and it's right now 3 p.m. Eastern. We're very excited to be joined today by best-selling author David Baldacci. My co-host today for the show is Miriam Parker from Grand Central Publishing. Hi, Miriam. How are you today?
Hi, Alan. I'm well. How are you?
Excellent. Excellent. Now, where are you calling in from, Miriam?
I actually work from home in southwestern Virginia, Blacksburg.
Southwestern Virginia, and I am in northern New Jersey. And so welcome to Blog Talk Radio. We're very excited about today's guest. And let me give a little introduction, and we'll bring our guest on to the show. Is that fine? David Baldacci was born in Virginia in 1960, where he currently resides. He received a Bachelor of Arts in Political Science from Virginia Commonwealth University and a law degree from the University of Virginia. Mr. Baldacci practiced law for 9 years in Washington, D.C. as both a trial and corporate attorney. David Baldacci has published 18 novels, including famous bestsellers such as Absolute Power, The Simple Truth, and The Camel Club. His most recent novel is Divine Justice, and we're very excited that David's here today. How are you, David?
I'm fine, thanks.
Excellent, excellent. So you're in Virginia now, I'm guessing?
Yes, I'm in Northern Virginia, although Mary and I was in Southern Virginia over the weekend at a lake house we have down there, and it was a little prettier down there.
It's very pretty here. It snowed here this morning. I don't know if you got that up there.
We did not. We just got miserable rain.
Yeah.
Well, as we said before the show went on air, it is winter, so.
It is, yes. What can you expect?
Exactly. Well, thank you for joining us here on Blog Talk Radio. We're very excited. We're going to take calls today later in the show. If people would like to call in and with a question, please do so. You can dial 347-677-0649. It's 347-677-0649. There's also a chat room, which is available during the live show. So feel free to pose a question in the chat, and we'll try to fit it in to the interview. So let's talk about Divine Justice and your most recent novel. What motivated you to write this book? What was your intent? What really, you know, drove you to write this latest novel?
Well, Divine Justice is the fourth installment in the Camel Club series, and at the end of the third installment, Stone Cold, I left my protagonist, Oliver Stone, not the film director, it's just an alias he uses, in a very precarious position. He had just assassinated two highly prominent government officials, people who had done great damage to he and his family about 30 years ago, and because of that, obviously, Oliver Stone has to go on the run. And the other members of the Camel Club, sort of this ragtag band of conspiracy theorists who had helped him throughout the first three novels, really he doesn't want to be with them anymore because he knows he's dangerous to be around. His idea is to get out of Washington, head south, try to start a new life and see if he can spend a few years at least in peace and quiet. But his plans go awry because of something that happens early on in the novel. He ends up in a little town of Divine, Virginia. It's a fictitious town. I created it. Don't try to find it on a map. You will not be successful because it's not there. It's a little coal mining town that's very representative of the places along the spine of the Appalachian Mountains in southwest Virginia. And Stone, when he gets there, it looks very idyllic. It sort of seems like Mayberry RFD, but once he starts scratching under the surface a little bit, he realizes that Divine Virginia might be just as lethal as the place he was trying to get away from.
And when did you begin thinking about this latest, the novel? And when did you start thinking about putting your thoughts together on it?
Well, you know, at the end of Stone Cold, I was sort of torn a little bit. One, I thought I could just end Stone Cold. That would be the last last book in the series of the Camel Club. And the way that ended, it sort of gave some resolution to Oliver Stone's life and all that he had been through, and I could have just stopped it right there. But I guess a couple of things. One, I like spending time with the Camel Club guys, particularly Oliver Stone. He's just a very unique character, and I like sort of drawing him on a page over and over again. And secondly, it was probably about 40,000 emails and letters I got from people around the country who said, you better write another Camel Club book or we're going to find you and hurt you really badly. So because of that, I thought, well, I want to be around a little longer, so I started putting pen to paper. And it wasn't that difficult to get motivated on this one because I had a lot of things that I'd built into the backstories of the first three books and also into the plot that was in Stone Cold that I could draw upon and bring back out in Divine Justice. So I had a little bit of a head start because of that. I do bring in some brand new characters that are new to this series, and so I had fun sort of that, you know, creating those and sketching their characters out. But I had a lot of fun taking Oliver Stone out of his comfort zone, Washington, D.C., and plunking him into a little town in Southwest Virginia and seeing what he could make of it and seeing if he could survive.
Miriam?
Yes. Well, my first question is that what's so great about Divine Justice is that it is equally satisfying if you've read the other books in the Camel Club series or if this is your first book in the series, and I'm so curious to know how you create that effect.
Yeah, you know, my publisher would want me to say that in order to fully enjoy the pleasure of Divine Justice, you should read all the books that I've ever written in my whole life, but you don't need to do that. I try to build into each book, even if it's a series. I have another series, my Secret Service Agents King and Maxwell. I sort of build in a little thumbnails of backstory into each to let you know what's happened before in earlier books and in the most recent book, give you a little backstory of their characters and how they came to be and how they came to be together. And I could do that very efficiently. Maybe it comes from my screenplay writing days, but I do that very efficiently early on, so you can follow the characters pretty much from the first chapter onward. And I like to do that just because I read a lot of, you know, books, and I read a lot of books that have recurring characters, and sometimes I read them out of order. And I like it when authors sort of give you that little cheat sheet early on and let you know a little bit about the history of the character so you can fully enjoy that book that you're reading now without having to go back and catch up with all the others. So I try to have that same effect. You can do it in any number of ways. Sometimes I do it through dialogue. Sometimes I just give you a little expository material where, okay, this is how they got here and this is where I think they're going to be going. So hang on and we just move the story forward. But I do that in every book of recurring characters, and I do it early on, so it doesn't interfere with your reading pleasure, trying to wonder how the heck did they get here and who are they really. So it's a device that I've used often, but I think it's, you know, it's an equitable one and allows all the readers to sort of hit the ground, you know, at the same spot on the starting line.
I think it's great. It's like just enough information for folks to be able to get what's going on and keep going, and just a little enough so that people aren't bored if they've read, you know, all the books.
That's right. Yeah, it's kind of a fence straddling there.
Right.
You don't want to do too much on one side and too little for the people who haven't read it before. But I think if, you know, you work on that, and I tend to massage that area quite a bit as I'm writing and going back and editing it out and adding little things in. And, you know, it's like Abraham Lincoln used to say when he would send out condolence letters to mothers of soldiers who had died in battle. He sent a very famous one to a woman who had lost 5 sons. It was sort of like, you know, earlier version of Saving Private Ryan. And he wrote her a very long letter, and he apologized for the length of it. And he said, if I had more time to write this letter, it would have been far shorter. And that just goes to show that, you know, it, really the economy of words, if you have too many words, it tends to dilute the ones that you have there. And I tend to go for more economic means of expressing myself, and doing the backstory early on is one of the ways I do that.
I mean, how long does it take you to write one of these, to write a novel such as Divine Justice?
Well, it used to. You know, I used to write a book a year. In the last 2 years, I've been doing 2 books a year, one in the spring and one in the fall. But I tend to overlap certainly the research and a little bit of the outlining. I think if I had to set a time certain on Divine Justice, it probably took me about 8 months, 8 to 8.5 months from start to finish to write that book. And, you know, there was a fair amount of research. I knew the area of Southwest Virginia very well. My mother's family's from there. I've been all over the Appalachian coal mining section of that part of the state. A couple of my uncles were miners. One of them actually died in a mining accident. So I understood that world pretty well. And then having the Camel Club sort of in my mind anyway after 3 books wasn't that difficult to sort of get back up to speed on them. Introducing new characters and the CIA angle, you know, took a little bit of time as well. But once I get past the first 100 pages and I get into a zone and a groove of where I want to go with the story and I know what I really want to do with it, I can be pretty productive and write pretty fast. The first 100 pages are difficult because I'm really not sure of my characters yet. I'm not sure of their capabilities. I'm not really even certain of which one's going to carry the heavy, you know, the laboring oar of the narrative. But once I get past 100, 150 pages, then I'm pretty good.
Do you have a certain area that you write from? I mean, in your home, or do you leave the family for a while? I mean, in terms of your writing style, I've had a lot of different interviews with authors, and they all have a different approach to it. Where do you really feel you can get best into your zone?
Yeah, the only perfect place to write is in your head. If you have to write in your head, you can write with a screaming baby on your lap, which I've done many times. You can write on a plane, on a train, by a pool, you know, sitting in, you know, anywhere. But it has to be right in your head. I don't have a special desk or a special pen or a special time I write during the day. My days are typical for being atypical. I don't write every day. I don't count words. You know, I seem like an insane sort of idea. You know, you write 2,000 words a day, and at the end you'll have, you know, X number of words. And I always kid my friends who do that, and I say, you know, it's the only reason you count words every day is because you just want to get to 2,000 so you get the hell out of there and do something you really want to do, which is not writing. I actually really enjoy the process of writing. And some days I write nothing because it hasn't really crystallized in my head about what I want to put down on a piece of paper. Some days I might write 10,000 words. I don't know. But so every day is different for me. But if you get it right in your head and you're in that zone, any distraction that's out there, you're sort of bulletproof against that. So I can write anywhere. I just came back from a book signing tour. I went to like 11 cities. I wrote the whole time. I wrote in the hotels. I wrote, you know, in the planes, the trains, the cars. It really didn't matter because I was sort of in that zone. I knew where I wanted to go.
How do you enjoy, I mean, I've been on a lot of road shows, mostly for raising money and, you know, through building companies, and I know it's going to many cities, it's not easy, but where do you generally go? Is it Northeast? Is it a national tour, or how does that work?
I usually break it up into sections, so every other year, for instance, I'll do the West Coast, then Midwest, South, Northeast, so we sort of see where we've gone in the past, where I haven't been in a while. Pick places on that. Sometimes a publisher will have suggestions about, you know, this bookstore really wants you and they've done a good job with you, or there's some great media here that they want you, so you go there because of that. So the different factors determining what this, you know, the space, the time, and the scope of the tour is going to look like. And, you know, I do book signings. On this last tour, I gave 4 speeches, three at universities, and another sponsored by a publishing company ran the Cincinnati Inquirer in Cincinnati, Ohio. They have a lecture series, the Niehoff lecture series. I went and did a lecture there. So, you know, it breaks it up for me. So I get to do not just media, not just book signings, but when I go out and do my little stand-up, you know, comedy routine, and also tack some serious points on to that. So people
can you give
us
a little here, the comedy routine, and maybe we'll get you a few little jokes over Blog Talk Radio, social media website. We can fit that in for sure. I think Miriam has a question for you.
Okay.
Well, actually, on the topic of travel, I noticed that in Divine Justice, as well as in some of your other novels, like The Christmas Train, trains play a very big role in the plot, and I wonder what your connection with trains is.
Yeah, I love trains, and I actually took the train trip that's depicted in The Christmas Train, taking 2 trains across the United States, and I did that because I was finishing up another novel. I just wanted 3 days by myself, no interruptions. But when you're on a train, unlike a plane, where if you look at somebody on a plane, you know, it's like they want to pull out a gun and shoot you. But on a train, people love to talk. And you go to the dining car, and you go to the observation car, and people just sit there, and they just BS you the whole time. Everything they're telling you is an absolute lie. I mean, how many times have I been on a train, and somebody told me that they're the long-lost son of, you know, JFK or whatever. It's just, but by the time when I got to California, I had like 50 pages of notes of this story. And I flew back home, and I spent the next year writing The Christmas Train because I just thought it was a cool sort of story, like this romantic screwball madcap comedy on a train across the United States over Christmas. That's where I got the inspiration for that. But trains in general, for me, they sort of have that nostalgic feel. I love the, you know, the film noir of that era when the 30s and 40s and people traveled by train. 20th Century was a classic comedy with Cary Grant and Eva Marie Saint, North by Northwest, the train trip, and it's just a classic feeling. And sometimes sitting on a train, it gets me in this amazingly creative mood where I've written, you know, huge portions of books while I've been on trains. Now, I can't take them all the time. Obviously, a lot of times I have to fly. I usually do, you know, at least one European book tour every year, sometimes 2, and you have to fly to places there. But even over there, sometimes if I could take a train, like the Channel train from London to Paris, I'll do that. It's just, I don't know, I feel very creative on trains. And there's something when I'm sitting in a car and I watch somebody go by or I see some scenery fly by that you can't see at 35,000 feet, it's amazing the spark that they can generate. And sometimes it leads you to a story otherwise you never would have gotten.
Right. Yeah, you're grounded. You're looking at, you know, people. And, no, I agree, farms and... I love the trains as well. And I was just going to say, in Europe, there's quite a bit of trains.
You get around. You go everywhere.
Between Paris and Brussels, for example, works out real well.
Yes. No. I've taken that one, too.
Yeah. So anyway, we're here today. We're talking with David Baldacci. We'll take some calls later into the show. The number is 347-677-0649. We have a live chat room that is on our site at blogtalkradio.com. You could find it on the homepage. And I was just going through the chat room, and there was someone in the chat room said, "Wow, he is good-looking man." We have your picture up on the profile on the Alan Levy Show, and few people actually said, "Boy, Alan, you are a pretty good-looking guy." And I have to say, you know, well, that is actually the guest on today's show. But you were cited in 1997 for a quite noted award. Wasn't that true?
Well, it was a distinction that my wife found very amusing, and yeah, it was the 50 most beautiful. But I have to point out that in that list that year, there were 48 actors, actresses, musicians, and athletes. There was one paleontologist, and I was the token writer. I think they had to fill that out so they could be deemed to be sort of a highbrow list. And that's the only reason I made it, I'm sure. And my wife will tell you a different version, but that's mine, and I'm sticking to it.
Yeah, we should have got her on here to talk about that, I'm sure. she would enjoy that question. There is a question from the chat room, and the question is, do you use digital recorders at all in your writing?
You know, it's funny, as a lawyer, I would do that sometimes, where I would dictate briefs and give them, you know, to my secretary to write them out. Sometimes when I'm traveling, I'll have a recorder, and if I see something, I'll sort of whip that out and speak into it and for later use. I don't dictate, you know, portions of the book, because I tend to do that either by longhand or on the computer myself. But definitely, you know, I take advantage of the technology that's out there, yes.
Now, you have, in some of the background materials, advised governments on certain security issues and whether it's, you know, governmental agencies. I wanted to ask you about that, and you know, have you written nonfiction, or is that something you would like to write about? I mean, given, you know, you are a lawyer and you're close to what's happening in D.C.
Well, you know, I think even though I write fiction, there's a lot of nonfiction in my novels where I research a lot. I talk about real places, real institutions, agencies, and I try to give you the procedures they use and the lingo they use and the equipment they use and all of those nonfiction. So that really does sort of satisfy any nonfiction appetite that I might have. The government, I think, you know, they have contacted me before, at least contractors working with the government, myself and other writers and screenplay writers, to sort of get out-of-the-box thinking on different scenarios. You know, they would contact you and say, here's a doomsday scenario, and they would tell you what it was, and they said, how would you go about doing that? How would you attack that event? How would you attack that facility? And you come up with a way to do it, and then they would take that way, and supposedly, I guess, they would reverse engineer it and figure out a way to prevent it from ever happening the way you had described. And I think, you know, it's commendable that they would go to people outside sort of the norm, outside of government, to creative minds to try to brainstorm. And, you know, I was flattered that they came to me and, you know, to sort of help protect the American people. And, of course, another part of me was terrified they had to come to people like me to help protect the American people, because you're thinking, you know, well, don't you have experts to sort of take care of this? And
right.
my wife would tell you that I'm not really up to the task. I don't do things that well. And you know, I think they were looking for creative input and wanted to go to non-traditional sources to get it. And I think that was a good thing.
Now, if in terms of a pure nonfiction book, I mean, what would, if you were to write one, what do you think you'd focus on? Is that something you've given thought to?
You know, I love
great questions.
I love biographies. I mean, I read a lot of historical nonfiction, and I'm a big David McCulloch fan, Edmund Morris fan. You know, presidential biographies, Michael Beschloss, and you know, the TR series, and you know, there's some great stuff out there. I think if I were going to dive into that, I probably would be in the field of biography. As a child, I read all the, I called them kid biographies, where, you know, they probably had a whole series of them in public school libraries, where you could go and they would tell you that the story of a famous person, but just right up until they became an adult. So I would read about Walt Disney or the Ringling Brothers or James Madison and lots of Thomas Edison, and they would tell you about their childhood. And then it would stop, and the story would end when they turned like 18, and there would be like one concluding chapter where it's like, and they did this great stuff, and then they died. You know, and I guess it was, the impetus was on you to, when you, you know, outgrew those books, to go and read, you know, the rest of the story. But so I think I would probably gravitate towards writing biography. I enjoy reading them immensely. I'm very much into history. And I grew up in the South in Virginia. You're taught, you know, everything about the Civil War, everything about, you know, all the Virginia presidents. Although they teach the Civil War a little bit differently in Virginia. You were taught the Civil War up until like the end of May 1863, and then after that, you come in the next day, and all of a sudden, you've taken this gigantic leap, and you're being taught about World War One. And I remember asking my fourth grade history teacher, you know, wasn't there 2 more years to the Civil War? And she said, you know all you need to know about the Civil War. And anybody who follows the Civil War knows that in the summer of 1863, that's when Gettysburg happened and the war turned against the South and it was all over. So I guess the teachers in the South didn't want us to really know about that.
Thanks. That's great to know. We have a caller, and I know, and it's the caller is wants to ask a question about something that's very important to you, and it has to do with the MS Foundation, where you are national ambassador.
Yes.
So if you wouldn't mind, I'd like to bring on a caller, and
sure.
Pat would like to ask you a question, and then we want to also get into Wish You Well Foundation. So I'm sorry about that. Let's just bring on. Yeah, hi, Pat. You're on the Alan Levy Show. How are you?
Hi, Alan. I'm fine. How are you today?
Very good. Where are you calling from, Pat?
Calling from Allentown, Bethlehem, Pennsylvania. We had talked to you last. We had talked to you last week when we talked about the Velveeta cheese and the.
And well, we have to give the background on the Velveeta.
I want to hear this segue.
Maybe David knows about Velveeta cheese.
Okay.
Being a Southerner.
We have to talk about Velveeta because we were scheduled to be on last week and it was a little confusion, so we got David on this week.
Uh-huh.
I was on a show last Tuesday night with Marla, who is the fly lady, who may have to call in later, too. But Marla has 505,000 Yahoo group members. She's the largest Yahoo group, period, by
right.
a magnitude of 10.
Right.
So we, on our show, we were talking about Velveeta, and they said they don't sell that north of Virginia. And and so we had this also... I guess
why shouldn't you have the fun?
So Pat called in and said, you know, we want to have a question for your guest. And by the way, you know, we live near a Velveeta plant in Pennsylvania or something like that.
We don't eat
anyway,
it. We don't eat
don't
it.
Eat
we
it.
Just live near there. Kind of clogs
well,
up your arteries.
And ship it down south, right?
And ship it down south, right, right. Being a Southern, being in the South, you've probably eaten Velveeta, David, I'm
yes,
sure.
Yes, I have.
My friend in Virginia makes her soup with Velveeta cheese.
Hey,
but,
I had a question.
But actually, well, I just wanted to comment, actually, and thank you for representing the Multiple Sclerosis Society. I have had MS for 28 years now. And was really good up until the last two have taken a downturn. But I wanted to thank you for that. And also to mention your sister's book.
Yes.
Which
Sundog
I had
Moment.
Read. Sundog
yes.
Moments, right, for anyone interested in MS. I think it's a good book. It's a novel, but written from the point of view of someone with MS.
That's right.
And I
could you please
just,
give the name of that book again so we could put it in the chat room?
It's Sundog Moment.
Okay, Sundog Moment.
Right,
yes.
By Sharon Baldacci.
Yes. No, thank
right.
you. I'm glad you enjoyed the book. I'll let her know that. And
I did. I actually had corresponded with her on email some time back.
Excellent.
And she's a nice lady.
Yes,
very,
she really
very
is.
Nice lady. So I wanted to thank you for that. I don't know, are you planning to do any events with the MS Society or
Yeah, I've certainly done all the money raising events they have.
Right.
The walk
right.
and the other bikeathon and
right.
I've done PSAs for them. I was on the board for years at the Richmond Multiple Sclerosis Society and
great.
And actually, I'm thinking about getting more involved with the capital, the Washington D.C. Capital Area
mm-hmm.
MS Society, because I mean, certainly that you know the treatments have gotten a lot better over the years.
Mm-hmm.
My sister was first, as you know, many years ago was probably the most misdiagnosed disease
yeah.
there was, and people
yeah.
would tell you you had this, this, and this, and you had none of those things. And
exactly.
So
exactly.
often, you know, she's had it for not quite as long as you, but probably for about 23 or 24 years.
I remember that. Yeah, I think that's what she had said. Yeah.
Right. And you know, some of the treatments they had are great, but only if you know, they diagnose really typically early.
And if you get to them early, that's right.
If you
right.
get to them early. And so and
that's
it didn't,
right.
really, didn't work out for her, but, you know, she's...
That's right. How is she doing?
She's doing well. She's hanging in there. She's
good.
You know, still mobile, and she's raised two sons to you
yes.
know adulthood. And
right.
I think, you know, with her, probably with any affliction like that, attitude is so important to keep a positive attitude.
It's very important. It
yeah.
really is. From and also a good support group.
Yes.
Your support group is probably one of the most important things that you can have. Because I do have a good support group, and I'm sure she does too.
Yes, she does.
Well,
and
Pat,
I have to tell you,
you have a great attitude. You have a wonderful attitude, and so you know, it's obviously
Through
very clear. And so thank you for calling.
Thank you, and I wanted to say, David, love your books.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that.
Haven't gotten the last Camel Club yet, but that one's on its way. So
okay, excellent.
We'll
have a good holiday.
Thank you. You too.
Thank
have
you
a good holiday, calling. Everybody.
Bye-bye.
Thank
bye.
You, Pat. And enjoy the cheese.
Oh.
No, don't. So. With the Lipitor included, we'll have to throw a little of that in there for you.
Oh, I'm not doing, even if it's chocolate covered, I'm not eating that Velveeta cheese.
Okay. All right.
Take
have
care. Bye.
Thank you for your call. One of the other things I wanted to talk about was the Wish You Well Foundation.
Yeah.
This is something that is very important, and we spent a lot of time. Blog Talk Radio is a platform that accommodates hundreds, if not thousands, of authors who come on here and do just what we're doing and interact with their fans and readers and really promoting literacy. And that's what you're focused on here. So let's talk a little about that and when you got involved and other things. Because I see that there's so many other programs that you're funding. I was trying to count the number of programs you fund, including the Barbara Bush programs. But let's talk a little about that.
Yeah, the Wish You Well Foundation. My wife and I have given a lot to charity over the years. We wanted to sort of focus our giving a little bit more. We founded a family foundation called Wish You Well. It's named after one of my novels. And we have a board of directors. We try to do it very professionally. We have an executive director, a full-time executive director, who runs our charitable programs, including Wish You Well. We get about 3,000 to 4,000 applications for money from across the country every year. We meet quarterly. We go through all the applications. We funded literacy programs in over 30 states and counting, and of all age groups and all sort of manner. And we do a lot of research into that. We try to help these organizations get better. We try to team up organizations in different parts of the country that have commonality of interests and purpose and mission. Secondly, we have a program called Feeding Body and Mind, where we team with America's Second Harvest, now called Feeding America. They're based in Chicago. They run all the nation's food banks. Obviously, people seeking food assistance do it because they're not self-sustaining. They don't have high marketable job skills. Oftentimes, they have illiteracy skills. It goes hand in hand. Poverty and illiteracy go hand in hand. So what I do on my book signing tours, we collect books all over the country. And when those boxes are full, then we pay to have them shipped to a local area food bank, whatever city I happen to be in. So if you give it in Minnesota, it stays in Minnesota, Virginia, South Carolina, wherever your local donations stay local. And then people who go in for food assistance go home with food, which they need to survive, but it can't get them out of that cycle of poverty. It just keeps them sort of marching in place. They go home with books. And having a book in a house, I've never seen a bad thing come out of that. You know, it instills a value to literacy and reading in your young kids and the adults. And that's how you break out of the cycle of poverty, by sort of changing the way you conduct your life and sort of the aspirations you have. So we're trying to get as many books into many homes as we possibly can to sort of, lift this country out. And we're a democracy, and it's you can't be both free and ignorant. They're mutually exclusive. And people who don't read are ignorant. They're intolerant. They sort of gravitate to these comfort zones of where they get their ideas and opinions from. And it's not healthy at all. We need to have a country that thinks for itself again, and it all starts with literacy. You can't think for yourself if you can't read.
Well, I have another individual who's calling in. It's Marla Silly. She is also known as the Fly Lady, as I mentioned earlier, who has
right.
a huge community. And Marla, you're on. How are you? Let's see. I think she's there in the chat, in the screening room. We actually have a little screening room on a switchboard here, so we'll put Marla on as soon as she's ready. What is your view about this Google initiative where it was an article in the New York Times recently where the books, they've now scanned millions and millions of books, and, what do you think that's going to do? You think that's going to enhance literacy dramatically? What's your view on in terms of Google's?
Well, it's kind of a fence straddle. On the one side, I can see the publishers and writers commercially looking at it and going, wait a minute, if people are going to be using my work and reading my work, I'd like to be, fairly compensated for it. I'm certainly am all for that. I don't want it to go the way of, illegally downloading and sharing musical files and movie files where people just sort of take your creative content for free and use it. There's nothing, you know, good or right about that. But at the same time, I think this, certainly Google is on to something, because in order to encourage people to read more, we need to go to the venues where they're going to be. I've had this discussion with, like, e-book readers for a long time now, where e-book readers seem to be, you know, just intrinsically perfect for textbooks for schools. You know, I have teenagers, and they lug, this is 2008, you know, everybody has a laptop, but they still lug like 85 pounds of books to school every day. And in college, you go through these college campuses, you go in the library, they brought their laptops, very streamlined, very high-tech, very great, super. They still got, you know, 1,000 pounds of books they have to buy every year and lug around, which for me, it just seems sort of counterintuitive. We have the technology, we should be able to use it. So I think we need to go to the venues where young people who don't necessarily read are. And if they're reading off computer screens and they're on Google and they want to share things, then that's fine. If you can work out a system where the people who create the content are fairly compensated and their rights are not taken advantage of, that needs to be done. But at the same time, if you can enhance the whole pool of readers and make that bigger and broader, then I think everybody wins at the end of the day.
Right. Marla, you're on, right?
Yes, I'm here.
Yeah,
hey, how are you?
I'm good, David. I'm enjoying your interview.
Thank you. I am too. I'm having fun.
So, Marla, talk about, you know, I know we spoke about family literacy, and that's, you said to me immediately, that's one of your causes that you really promote. I mean, talk about that, you know, that's why I thought it would make sense for you to come on at this moment.
Well, children learn to read by watching their parents. My grandchildren get read to every night. They love books. In fact, I'm giving my grandson a book for his birthday tonight, a book about how things are made. So they like pictures, too, and getting children involved in reading, you got to give them books that they want, not just say, oh, this is the classic, you're supposed to read this. They've got to get involved in it, and to get them interested in it, you got to read to them sometimes. And I think it's important when parents are so busy that they don't have time. I hate those words, I don't have time. I'm trying to give parents more time so that they can sit down and enjoy their children instead of the children hanging onto their legs.
So what is your view about the Google, you know, about what Google's doing and in terms of, you know, the way they're approaching, you know, copyrighted material and in terms of the, just scanning every book they can possibly find? I think there's something like 7 million books. It's an amazing number they've now scanned.
Well, it, being an author, too, I understand what David's saying. You know, I own my copyright until 75 years after my death. So, you know, for somebody to take my material and, you know, put it without my permission, I don't much like that. You know, is it the Gutenberg Foundation that does a lot of the older literature works on the computer? I like to read on a computer personally, but we as authors need to be compensated in the process. Hillary was scanning my call. Previewing my call when y'all were talking about that, so I'm sort of left out of the loop. I don't really know what you're talking about, but if Google's scanning books, then authors need to be compensated.
Yeah, that's pretty much what it is. And they started out scanning, I guess, the older classics where the copyrights might have expired, and they wanted to sort of give that to a broader audience online where, you know, kids are more likely to sort of matriculate to. But I think, too, you know, the logical conclusion to that is they want more contemporary work as well. They want to be able to scan it and have it available. And, of course, there has to be some type of system set in place that protects writers and publishers who invested a lot of time and money and effort into creating the content. And before you can't simply give it away and not have people compensated, because at the end of the day, you won't have any content to give away anymore because people will just stop doing it. They won't be able to afford to do it anymore. So I think there has to be a compromise made where everybody's sort of win-win. I agree with you, though, that you make a reader early, you make a reader for life. And so many parents have come up to me at events, and they say, you know, I can't get my kids to read. I don't know what the issue is. And the first thing I always ask them is, do you read? And typically the answer is, well, you know, I'm really busy. I come home, we have dinner, and I get to jump on the computer to send off emails. And I say, well, if you're on the computer, your kids are going to be on the computer. If you make reading fun, if you make it creative, all kids want to be creative. It's only adulthood that beats the creativity out of all of us. And if you read a book with your kids, if you act out a book with your kids, if you take different parts, and if a kid doesn't like the ending of a book, challenge them to write a better one, and then they can read it to you, and then you can all sort of talk about it. If you make it a creative endeavor, which all writing is creative, it's not just trying to sit down and read page, you know, words on a page, and that can sound dull and boring, but if you talk about how that book was created, the circumstances behind it, something about the author, kids just naturally gravitate to that. They really want to know that type of story.
They like the in-depth study. They want to get right to the meat of stuff and know what makes somebody tick, and sometimes we've lost that curiosity as an adult.
No, we have. You know, we sort of get into our own little comfort zones, and we have the blinders on, and we don't want to have any new experiences, because sometimes it can be frightening, and we want to be where we're comfortable and we know what's going to happen. But that's not what kids want. Kids want new and adventurous and different. They want to be challenged. They want to be frightened sometimes, and that's just all a part of growing up, and we need to accommodate them on that.
My husband is an attorney and getting ready to retire as a judge for 20 years, and he's going to be home, so I've talked him into writing a novel.
Good.
He walks in the woods. When you were talking about riding on the train and all this stuff, he says he walks in the woods and creates characters and storylines. And so I think by the time he retires at the end of this year, next year we'll have a novel out of him.
Excellent. That's great.
Well, thank you, Marla. Appreciate your call.
Oh, glad to be here. Anytime.
Okay. Prior to you joining us, I was talking to Miriam about your website, and it's quite extensive, and I did a little research, and let's talk a little about your website, and have you embraced kind of some social media tools and other things? I mean, have you thought about, for example, using a tool like Blog Talk Radio to promote your ideas or communicate with people and so on?
Yeah, you know, typically I'll do like Blog Talk Radio. I've done it overseas. There's a site in Britain when I was over the last time that I sat down and did an on-camera blog, talking about issues and taking calls from people. I have thought about that. I'm thinking about, you know, sort of creating a blog on my website that I can send out to people on our subscription list and let them know what's going on. And I know you can do that on Amazon as well, send out blogs. It certainly is. It is definitely, you know, an area that that all authors, I think, need to be take advantage of, because that's really where a lot of people are, not just kids, but adults as well. And the website has been a very powerful tool for us. You know, we do an online book signing. I think I was the first writer to ever start one like 7 years ago, where I would do an online book signing. You could write in, request book plates, wherever you are in the world, and then, you know, free of charge, I'd send you signed book plates and bookmarks and stuff, and you get them before Christmas. And people have really responded, you know, really well to that. We send out now like 16,000 or 17,000, you know, every time. And so the website is a very powerful tool. It gets a lot of information out to people, you know, with a click of a mouse key in a very efficient, economical sort of way. And
that's David Baldacci. I'm sorry for interrupting, but I just wanted to make sure everyone listening knew it's at davidbaldacci.com.
That's right. Very easy to remember.
Yeah.
And we thought about actually doing a blog component to the website where you can see me on camera, you know, talking about something that's interesting to me. A lot of times where I've been on camera, you can go on like on YouTube. There's a little YouTube channel, David Baldacci. Go on there and do see some of the interviews I've done, some of the television commercials I've done for my books. You know, I've done a couple of television shows like Murder by the Book on Court TV, and you can go and watch those. It's a great avenue, a great venue to get things out and let people sort of interact with you.
Mm-hmm. Well, we have found that with Blog Talk Radio particularly, you're using a phone, and so am I, and so is Miriam, and so is and the callers. So it's an audio platform that's interactive with live chat and people, of course, calling in, and it's all, you know, browser-based, and so it's quite easy to you know, engage your audience and wherever you may be. So
we've had a number.
We had Brad Thor. He was doing his book tour, and he did a Blog Talk Radio show from Boston. He had an evening available, and he did an hour and a half show during the book tour, The First Commandment, and he was taking calls from around the world using this tool. So we'd love to talk to you about it offline and to kind of show you some of the things we're doing here. I'm on the site. It's quite extensive, and you really do. It seems like it's updated quite often. Do you have a team? Do you have a team of people that handle this, or are you really managing the site?
Yeah, no, I have people who do that for me. You know, a lot of the obviously a lot of the creative input, e-letters we send out to people and all that, I create those. But as far as the day-to-day operation of the stuff, I have other people who handle that. They update it and, you know, put new visuals on it, new material on it. We have things that rotate out on a cycle, on a loop, so they keep it sort of fresh and entertaining and new all the time. So people can go back and they'll say, you know, that's new. I want to, you know, that's how you get the eyes coming back, constantly changing the, you know, the content on there.
Mm-hmm. Miriam?
Yes.
Go ahead.
I wanted to ask you one more question about your books, if that's okay.
Sure.
My dad is a huge fan of your books, and when I told him we were talking with you today, he was so excited, and he always has a very practical question. And his question is, how does Oliver Stone / John Carr survive when he's not to sort of support his life of fighting crime?
Yeah, you know, it's one of those things where if you live simply, you can get by on very little. And he's got room and board when he was, a cemetery caretaker. And so he had a roof over his head and, a little bit of money. And he also has friends that support him that he can rely on. But, one of the things in the book that I had to deal with sort of head on was the fact the lack of funds that he had. And when I sort of removed him from that comfort zone and his circle of friends and the job that he had, I had to put him to work again. And, he had to do work to earn money and divine justice, and he had to worry about, the money that he spent, and he just lived very frugally. And apparently, as all of America is doing right now, since our economy has totally imploded. But that was one of the issues. He's a very frugal guy. He lived very simple wants in life and doesn't need a whole lot to survive. And I think it's amazing that once you sort of cut out all the stuff you don't need in life, how very little you can get by on, essentially, that you do need. And he's just sort of a guy who's never had a whole lot in his life, and I don't, he doesn't miss the things he's never had. But it is tough. He does have to worry about money.
My dad is very concerned about it.
Yeah, no, he's not Bruce Wayne. He doesn't have that inheritance to fall back on. There's no bat cave.
No bat cave here?
No bat cave. Okay. I forgot to build a bat cave in.
Okay. Well, I wanted to know what's up next. I mean, what are you planning? Your next? You thinking about that? Do you like
I'm almost out down the road. I'm almost done with the next book. Actually, I'll be done by the end of the year. It's another Sean King and Michelle Maxwell. And I've written three books with them: Split Second, Our Game, and Simple Genius. And in the Simple Genius, I left a lot of issues unresolved with both of them, particularly Michelle Maxwell. So in this book, I sort of bring them back, take care of those issues, put them into a new adventure. Again, tackling something new and different for me, in creating one character in this book that's totally new for me. I've never really done a character like this before, but it's been a lot of fun, and that'll be out in the spring of next year.
Well, it's great, and maybe we can get you back on to have another conversation here on Blog Talk Radio.
That'll be fun, yeah.
We've pretty much winding down the show. Our guest has been David Baldacci, and our audience has been getting some chat and email in. They really enjoyed this. The archive of this interview and conversation can be found on blogtalkradio.com/AlanLevy, as well as one of the profiles of Grand Central Publishing on Blog Talk Radio, right, Miriam?
Yes, it'll be on, so that's Blog Talk Radio / Grand Central Pub.
Okay, excellent. So thank you for joining us. We appreciated it. Look forward to speaking again and keeping in touch with your next book.
I appreciate it, too. I had a lot of fun. It was good talking to you, and it's good talking to you again, Miriam.
Yeah, likewise.
Excellent.
Have a great
holiday.
Thank
you for calling.
Okay, you too.
Excellent.
Take care.
Have a great holiday,
bye.
David. Thank you.
All right, bye.
Great, thank you, Miriam. David was wonderful, and clearly the audience really enjoyed that interview.
Yeah, he's fantastic. He's so smart and articulate. It's great to talk to him.
Yeah, it is amazing that for a publisher, I guess having an author that publishes a book, two books a year, that's pretty good production, I'd say.
Oh, we're all shocked and amazed by it, because every book is great too. I mean, there's never like a stinker in the bunch. Every time you read one, you're like, God, these are so good, and they keep the pages turning, but they're really in depth too. Like, they're not just plot outlines, in book form. The characters are so, have so much depth to them, and he's really the best. So.
Right. Well, let's leave it on that note. There's no stinker in the bunch. So, Mary, thank you for. Thank you for doing this, and I look forward to another interview with you and Grand Central and other folks at Hachette. And you've listened to The Alan Levy Show. Thanks, Miriam.
Thank you.
And we'll wind it down. Thank you, everyone in the chat room.
Thanks for joining Alan and Hillary on The Alan Levy Show.
Make sure to join the conversation by calling 347-677-0649 and listen to The Alan Levy Show on Blog Talk Radio.